Several weeks ago, we began to talk about the judges. We had one lesson, sort of an overview, introductory lesson, and then we began talking about the various judges. We made a chart out. We had Othniel and Ehud and Shamgar that we looked at first. Othniel, you'll recall, was the nephew of Caleb. Ehud was the left-handed assassin, and Shamgar slew 600 Philistines, I believe, with an ox goad. And so these were great men. That they were actually regular men that God raised up and made great by giving them great things to do and giving them the wherewithal to accomplish what he assigned to them. And then 2 weeks ago, we talked about Deborah. She was already serving as a judge, but then God needed her to initiate this military action against the king of Canaan to throw off the domination that the Israelites were suffering under. She got Barak involved to help lead some of the troops, and they defeated the forces of Canaan. She judged for about 40 years. This morning, we're going to talk about Gideon, and it's going to take all the time we have to get through Gideon. There's a lot revealed to us about this particular judge. As always, the Israelite people fell back into worshiping idols as soon as Deborah was dead and gone, didn't have her leadership. They began to worship idols. In Judges 6, the first two verses, "Then the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hands of Midian for 7 years. The power of Midian prevailed against Israel." And you think, well, 7 years is not bad. Folks, this was not your average oppression. It was severe. It was so bad that many of the Israelites had to run to the hills, run to the mountains, and live in caves and strongholds. They would go down and sow their crops, and then the Amalekites and the Midianites and the sons of the east would come through with an innumerable number of camels, and they would, what they didn't eat and steal, they destroyed of their crops. They would take their animals. I mean, this was dire. These people were in dire straits. They were in fear of starvation even during this 7-year period. And so, of course, they cried out to the Lord and asked for his help. Now, God sent them a prophet to explain to them exactly why you're suffering what you're suffering. It's because you won't remain faithful to me. And I bless you beyond all measure when you're faithful to me, but you turn your back on me and serve idols. And of course, this kind of punishment is going to come upon you. But he listened to their cries, and he had compassion on them, and he determined to raise up a judge to help them. And his choice of men is interesting, because in Gideon's own description of himself, he was the youngest son in the least significant family in the tribe of Manasseh. And the angel of the Lord finds him hiding in a wine press. And apparently he's gotten his hands on some wheat that the Midianites overlooked or didn't find. And so he sneaks it to this wine press, and he's beating out the wheat in this wine press behind closed doors, because he doesn't want the Midianites to come and take his food and have his family starve to death. Manasseh felt totally inadequate for the task of leading some sort of military charge against the Midianites. And according to worldly standards, he was right. He was a nobody. He was a farmer. And yet notice how the angel of God addresses him when he first meets him. "The Lord is with you, O valiant warrior," he says. Here's this lowly farm guy, and he's out there beating out wheat. What does he know about waging war? And of course he questions, where's God been when we needed him? And of course the prophet of God made that perfectly clear. "You're suffering because of the sins that you've committed against me." But God tells Gideon, "Go in your strength and deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you?" See, it doesn't come down to your personal strength. If I've sent you to carry out this work, then you can do it. You can accomplish what I assign for you to do. And so then Gideon wants him to show him a sign. And I'll tell you, this is not the last time that Gideon wants a sign. And yet in every case, I would challenge you to look for any anger, any disappointment, any aggravation on God's part. God expects him to want to make sure that he's getting the right message from the right person before he embarks on something so consequential. Gideon wasn't questioning God's authority. He wanted to make sure he was hearing it from the horse's mouth. He wanted to make sure there wasn't some man posing as an angel of God trying to get him to do something. And so he prepared a young goat and unleavened bread and broth in a pot, and he brought that meat and that unleavened bread and that broth to the angel, and the angel told him to put it on a rock, and the angel touched it with the end of his staff, and fire shot up out of the rock itself and devoured that meat and that bread and the broth out of the pot. There was no doubt after this occasion that Gideon knew he was talking to the right person, and this was an angel of God who was giving him a message from Jehovah God. But then God gives him some specific instructions in Judges 6, beginning in verse 25. Take your father's bull and a second bull, 7 years old. Don't know why, but that's what God said. And pull down the altar of Baal, which belongs to your father, and cut down the Asherah that is beside it, and build an altar to the Lord your God on top of this stronghold in an orderly manner, and take a second bull and offer a burnt offering with the wood of the Asherah, which you cut down. Okay, and so I'll tell you, this is bold action. Everybody in his society, everybody in his community looked to the altar of Baal that belonged to his father, and that Asherah, no doubt they would carve that out of a tree that's still stuck in the ground. Every time I hear about them getting rid of an Asherah, they had to cut it down. They couldn't just pull it down. So apparently they would take a tree that's still growing and carve it into this female deity that was the counterpart to Baal. And so I want you to cut that thing down and use that wood to burn on the altar to offer me this burnt offering. And so he goes by night. He does what God says, but he takes some men with him and he carries this out at night. But he does everything God commanded him to do. He's not even sure how his father's going to react and his father's servants. He fully expects to be in just as much trouble at home as he is with the other townspeople. And yet he goes and does what he's told. Now, of course, the reaction the next morning with the townspeople is outrage. In verse 30 of Judges 6, then the men of the city said to Joash, this is Gideon's father, the men of the city said to Joash, bring out your son that he may die, for he has torn down the altar of Baal, and indeed he has cut down the Asherah which was beside it. Now, the question is, if you're reading this for the first time, the question that pops into your head is, how is Joash going to react? And there's nothing told to us about any prior conversation between Joash and his son Gideon. But it seems to me they've had some conversation. And Joash has had some time to consider. He's not getting hit with this by surprise. He knows his altar's been torn down. He knows the Asherah's been cut down. And he's already had time to consider how he feels about it. Which side of this issue is he going to take? And so his response to these townspeople is, will you contend for Baal or will you deliver him? Now stop and think about what you're saying. This is a mighty God in your mind, and his altar's been destroyed. Are you going to come in and contend on his behalf? Are you going to deliver this God that's supposed to be so mighty? And he takes his stand on this issue. He said, whoever will plead for him, for Baal, shall be put to death by morning. Okay? If Baal is a god, let him contend for himself because someone has torn down his altar. Okay? My son tore down this altar. If Baal is mad about that, let Baal take care of my son. And so he even changed his, or at least he named his son, Jerubbaal, which meant let Baal contend against him. And I will tell you, the name stuck. I know it did, because down toward the end of the story of Gideon, the Holy Spirit uses the name Jerubbaal to refer to Gideon. The name stuck. And every time somebody called out, well, there's Jerubbaal, it reminded them of the fact that he tore down Baal's altar and Baal didn't do a thing. He's still walking around breathing, happy and healthy. Baal is nothing. And here's a guy wearing a name to prove that. And if there's something powerful about Baal, he shouldn't be letting this fellow walk around with that name on him. Let Baal contend against him is what his father named him. And so Joash took his stand with Jehovah God and with his son Gideon. Now, that was task number one. You send this loud and clear message to the Israelite people that Jehovah God is not going to tolerate this. We're not going to have Baal worship among us. But now it's time to take care of the Midianites. Well, the enemy forces must have caught wind of the fact that there's some stirrings down there in Israel, because they got their forces together. The Midianites got with their buddies, the Amalekites and the sons of the east, and they encamped at the valley of Jezreel across the Jordan. No doubt they came from the west side of the Jordan, came across the Jordan over to the east side, and came across to the west side where the Israelites are at. We'll look at a map in a minute and it will help. But then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and that's important. Now he has the Spirit of the Lord to help him, and no doubt to help him with strategy and whatever else. And he gathered men from Manasseh and Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali, and they gathered at the spring of Herod. And we'll notice that all these tribes are up north, so apparently that's where the main conflict was going to take place. But he asked God for another sign. And again, God is not angry whatsoever. There are lives of men at stake here. He's going to lead men into battle. He wants to make sure you got the message straight and that he's doing what God wants. So he said, just have patience with me. I'm going to leave some fleece out here. And when I come back in the morning, help me by making the fleece wet and the ground dry. And so he comes back in the morning, he can wring water out of the fleece and the ground's dry. He said, please have patience with me one more time. Let me come back in the morning and the fleece be dry and the ground's wet. And he came back and that's exactly what he found. And so he feels confident leading these men into battle, knowing that he's doing the right thing, that God is with them. Okay? Now, God, they started out with about 32,000 men. I had to back into the math, okay? It didn't start out saying that. But they started with about 32,000 men that they'd gathered from Manasseh and Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali. And God said, that's just too many. Now, later you can do some math and find out that the enemy forces are 135,000. And God said, I'm sorry, 32,000 is too many. Because when you win the battle, and you will, there'll be Israelites that will say, well, we did it under our own power. We did it. Look at what we accomplished. Too many men. I want you to accomplish this with a lot fewer men than that. Then the Israelites will know that I gave the Midianites into your hand and it's all me. Really had very little to do with you. And so he goes to this 32,000. He said, any of you who are afraid, just go home. No questions asked. You're not in trouble. But if you're afraid, just go home. We just don't need you. And 22,000 went home and left 10,000. Okay. And you know what God said? Too many. You can defeat 135,000 with 10,000 is too many. Somebody is going to claim that they were just magnificent warriors. And so you take them down to the river and let them drink some water. Now, I've heard people try to explain, well, there are certain people that drank water a certain way, and that would indicate that they were alert soldiers. I think that's all, in my humble opinion, that's all hogwash. He could have said, anybody with blue eyes, I'll keep them. And among Israelites, there would have been very few blue eyes, you know. I mean, this was as random as you could possibly get. God is saying, I don't care who you could take a bunch of old women and children out there, 300 of them, and I would deliver 135,000 to you because I'm doing it. It doesn't matter who the soldiers are. And so 300 of these fellas lap water with their tongue like a dog, and the other 9,700 stuck their face down to the water to drink, and God said, that's my 300. That's the way they happen to drink water. I'll take the 300. Thank you very much. It was just a random way of cutting it down to a ridiculously small number of men. And God said, I'm going to defeat that massive army over there with 300 men. Now, how am I going to do that? Well, of course, Gideon used the strategy that God gave him. I want to back into this. It helps me sometimes to sort of put myself in other people's shoes. You know, put yourself in the shoes of a Midianite. You're in an encampment of 135,000 mighty warriors, and you're sleeping like a baby because, after all, you're in control. You've been owning these guys for 7 years, taking whatever you wanted from them. And so you're sleeping soundly. Now, all of a sudden, you're awakened by shouts and the sounds of trumpets. And you look around and there are torches all around your encampment and there are 300 trumpets blaring and then people shouting a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. You know how many trumpets? I don't know, but you speculate in your own mind. How many trumpeters would a massive army need to let the army know when to charge, when to retreat? Those, you think they need? I mean, how massive an army could you have with 300 trumpets? I would think two or three or four trumpets would cover an average army. And they hear this blasting of 300 trumpets. They have no idea how massive this force is. All they see is nothing but torches because every one of the 300 had one. And every one of the 300 had a trumpet. And every one of the 300 is shouting when they're supposed to. That's what these Midianites woke to. And they wake out of their sleep and they grab their weapons and it's nothing but chaos. It's a battlefield and they start killing people. They think they're killing Israelites. And what they're killing is other Midianites and Amalekites. Now, did God have a hand in that? I think God had a hand in that. We call it friendly fire. This was friendly fire on steroids, okay? Because about 120,000 eventually, 120,000 out of 135,000 end up dying. Right? Well, some of those were killed by Israelites, but a lot of them were killed by other Amalekites and Midianites, and God had something to do with that. Now, here's the map. Maybe that helps a little bit. The red little oval that you see there is where the forces of Midian and Amalek and the sons of the east gathered, and then just south of that is Herod's well or Herod's spring. That's where Gideon gathered his forces from Manasseh and Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali, and then they cut their forces down to 300 and surrounded them, and we know the rest of that story. But when they are routed, when the enemy forces are routed, they head south, southeast toward the Jordan, and they start heading down the Jordan Valley. They head past Beth Shittah and Abel Meholah, whatever that is. But they're heading south down the western shore of the Jordan River, and so Gideon calls on the rest of his forces to help pursue these remaining fleeing forces. But then he can see that they're heading further south, and so he sends messengers to Ephraim down here in the south and says, you need to send forces over and take the waters as far as Beth Bara, so that it's going to limit how far these guys can go. And sure enough, the Ephraimites encountered some of these forces and fought against them and captured Oreb and Zeb. The old King James says they were princes, or they were leaders. They were like military leaders for some of the forces. They captured them, put them to death, and brought their heads to Gideon across the Jordan. Well, that's the reason it said that, is because if you look at the arrows, as Gideon and his forces are heading south, part of the enemy forces cut across the Jordan, probably to avoid the Ephraimites. And so they cut across the Jordan with them to follow them and pursue them. Of course, by this time, they are exhausted. They're worn out. And so they stop at Succoth and they ask the men there, "We need bread. These men are hungry. They've been pursuing these enemy forces." And the men of Succoth said, "Have you won yet? Do you have the kings in your hand yet?" "Well, no, we're pursuing them." "Well, come back and see us when you've won, you know." They don't want to jump on Gideon's side and then Gideon lose and then have these kings come back and punish them for taking the wrong side. They think they're going to ride the fence. There is no fence to ride. They've got a choice to make, and they made their choice. And it was against Gideon and his soldiers. And Gideon said, "I will be back and I will discipline you with thorns." And then when he got to Penuel, they gave him the same response. "Let us know when you win." And he said, "I'm going to come back and tear down this tower." And they continued on. But they finally caught up with those kings and the remaining 15,000 down in Karkor, defeated those forces, killed those two kings. And then Gideon went back up to Succoth and Penuel and took care of business. He took the men of Succoth out and beat them, maybe, perhaps publicly, with thorns to discipline them. But at Penuel, he tore down their tower and killed the men there. And so he punished them for taking the side of the enemy forces instead of the side of the Lord. Well, that was the battles. And that's, Gideon was successful in defeating those forces and liberating the Israelite people from this oppression. Now, the reaction of the Israelites may have been understandable, but it was not pleasing to God. They went to him in chapter 8 and verse 22. They not only offered to make Gideon king, they offered him a dynasty. Look at that. "Rule over us, both you and your son, and also your son's son." This will just be a dynasty. "Your family deserves to rule over us, as bad as we had it with the Midianites, and you've delivered us." And so if you look at this little organizational chart we created a few weeks ago, this is the way God intended to manage, to govern his theocracy with the Israelite people, if you will. He said, "I will be your God, and you will be my people. I will be your king over you." But then they had the Mosaic law, written law, to govern them. They had the priests to help them with their spiritual guidance and so forth. He brought up judges when they needed them, but they wanted to take God off the throne and put Gideon on there. And Gideon's response was, in verse 23, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord Jehovah shall rule over you." He understood this org chart. He understood how God intended for things to be, and he was humble enough to say, "It's wonderful that I could help throw the Midianite oppression off, but I'm perfectly happy to just do my part as judge over you." And of course, he did that. There are some lessons that I think we can learn as we wrap up this study. And I think I skipped some. No. Okay. Anything can be an idol. And sort of the dark note at the end of Gideon's life was that he said, "I don't want to be king, but just bring me your gold and I want to make an ephod." Now, an ephod is kind of weird to us, but God had Moses make an ephod for the high priest to wear and had the 12 stones that represented the 12 tribes. Later, much later, when David was around, he would have the priest bring the ephod and he would use it to consult with God to find out how God wanted him to rule and decisions he wanted him to make. It may be that that's what Gideon had in mind, was to make an ephod that he had and would use that to consult God. I don't know. His intentions may have been good, but at some point the Israelites began to worship that. It reminds me of when God told Moses to make the bronze serpent to put up on the pole. That was exactly what God commanded him to do at the time. The problem is they kept that thing around, and over the years the Israelite people began to worship that thing as a god. And over in 2 Kings 18 and verse 4, in the period of the divided kingdom, good King Hezekiah is enacting reforms and getting rid of idol worship, and he had to destroy that bronze serpent because the people of Israel had been worshiping that thing. And so even something that is innocent and good can become an idol. And so we find Gideon judging for 40 years, and they were undisturbed during that time. He was a real blessing to the Israelite people. Now let's look at some quick lessons here. Number one, God can accomplish some great things through weak men and women. Okay, and that wasn't just in Gideon's day. That's throughout human history. God has taken just common people and accomplished fantastic things with them. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 1, 26 through 29, "Consider your calling, brethren, that there are not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong, and the base things of the world and the despised. God has chosen the things that are not, so that he may nullify the things that are, so that no man can boast before God." He's using weak men and women to accomplish great things, so that when great things are accomplished, he can say, "It wasn't them, it was me." And those who stand and shake their fist pridefully at the God who created them don't stand a chance when they stand before him in judgment. He will not tolerate that kind of pride and haughtiness. He's looking for the humble. And then God can accomplish great things. God can accomplish great things. Through a small, committed group of people who can make a real difference. Okay. You always need to remember that 300 versus 135,000, I think, is impressive. Joshua told the Israelite people in Joshua 1:9, "Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." Paul wrote in Romans 8:31, "What should we say then to these things? If God is for us, who is against us?" And so even in a place like this, we can be committed to the cause of Christ in this place. We can stand shoulder to shoulder in love with one another and do everything we can to contribute to the work here. And we can accomplish great things with God's help. We need to beware of idols that don't look like idols. There are things that are not inherently evil in and of themselves, but they can become idols to us if we allow them to become more important to us than the things of God. Materialism can be a serious concern for us. Over in Colossians 3:5, Paul was listing some deeds of the flesh, some things that the members of our earthly bodies would like to be engaged in if we just turned them loose. And one of those is greed or covetousness, which amounts to idolatry. We need to be careful about the material things of this life. Nothing wrong with them. We need to use them the way God wants us to use them. But if we start allowing them to become too important to us, we can be guilty of idolatry. And then finally, God wants us to question the sources of religious authority, religious doctrines. When we ask those kinds of questions, God's not angry at all. He wants us to ask those questions. And when people come in with doctrines, we ought to be going to the scriptures like the Bereans did and find out whether the things that they're teaching are so. And if they are not, we ought to turn a deaf ear to them. John said in 1 John 4 and verse 1, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world." We need to be cautious about that. And God doesn't mind us asking questions. But we need to be asking the right questions to find out what His will is and then do those things in our lives. Well, if you're this morning, you're not a Christian. You need to be one. You need to be a child of God. And if it's your desire to be baptized into Christ this morning, we would love to help you with that. If you're here and you're a Christian and there's something in your life that you haven't resolved with God, there's some sin that you haven't repented of, you need to go to Him and ask for His forgiveness. And if there's something we can do to encourage you in that, we would love to do that. If you're subject to the invitation this morning, come forward and let us know while we stand together and sing.